Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Book Spider podcast. It's a podcast in which we talk about books and hope that you enjoy listening and maybe are drawn to some of the books that we discuss if you haven't read them already. And that's particularly pertinent today because valued co-host Patrick Barney is going to talk with us a bit about some big news about his upcoming novel, Gusano. He's with us today, as well as Hans Berger, our other co-host, and my name is Chris Malmberg. But first, I'm going to hand it over to Patrick Barney. Patrick, you have an excerpt to share, I believe.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. Yeah, I just wanted to share that for those who may be interested, I've written a novel, and I'm the publishing date is coming up through an independent press. They're called Anxiety Press. They publish pessimistic novels and other literary works to kind of go along with our, you know, these dwindling times that we live in. And I wrote a novel. It's a comedy horror novel called Gusano, about a man who discovers one day that he can turn people into giant worms. And, you know, all the horror and hilarity that follows from that when hijinks ensue. So by the time this podcast goes live, the book should be available on Anxiety Press's website. All you would have to do is Google Anxiety Press, go to their books page, and the one that I wrote by Patrick Barney, Gusano, G-U-S-A-N-O. So I'm going to read a short excerpt, hopefully to kind of give you a taste of what it's all about. A couple minutes before 3 o'clock, Mick sat at the conference table and dialed in the SAP number. Kylie and Patrick came over after a minute too, Patrick with his notebook and leaning far back in his chair with his belly sticking up. Kylie sat right up against the table and hunched over her notes. They all listened for the SAP exec to join. Mick? A voice asked after a minute or so. Hey, Gary, it's Mick Jansen here. How's your day going so far? Great, great. Good to talk to you guys again. How are things down in Cincinnati? Couldn't be better, Mick said. Bengals are shit as always, and people around here still love their disgusting skyline, but we're good. Gary chuckled on the other end. Well, Chicago's pretty good, too. Excellent. So, the agenda today is to talk about the Barcelona conference, right? That's my understanding, Mick said. Per our contract, we're looking for you to find 3 speakers that can go and share their expertise. Mick nodded to himself. Yep, that's what we agreed to. But quick question, are you looking for tech speakers or brand speakers? Definitely brand speakers. The bigger the better, Gary laughed. No problem. And given the times, we're also hoping to have a diverse set of panelists, not just the white guys. Mick asked, if I find a black trans woman to speak, does that count as 3? Gary laughed again. We're hoping to have a really good conference, and we're counting on you to get the right speakers. We're on it. And when is your flight coming in? We'd like to chat in person before things kick off in Spain. Mick hesitated a long moment. Yeah, let's see. The first day of the conference is the 18th of next month. So, yeah, probably the 16th. Good. Plenty of time. And just for my benefit, what names do you have in mind? Jan at Nike, Linda at Chipotle, some others? Okay, excellent. They spent the next 45 minutes discussing minutiae that bored him, and he couldn't quite keep track of the words they were saying. The atmosphere on their end sounded thick. Guess 2 Adderalls weren't enough anymore. He twitched his leg up and down, saw Patrick doodling in his notebook, Kylie actually being a fucking champ and taking notes. Good. He'd talk to her later, have her translate the little stuff for him. He knew he'd have to bust his ass to get speakers to the conference, but he didn't want to think of that now. Instead, to focus on something, he multiplied 3-digit numbers in his head. 352 by 190, 234 by 861, 712 by 447. He wasn't certain he was getting the right answers, but as long as he had a problem in his head to think about, instead of Gary's stupid droning, he felt a little bit better. When the call ended, he walked back over to his desk and grabbed his keys and wallet and his duffel bag. He slung it over his shoulder and headed to the door. Before leaving, he turned to face his employees. "All right, good day, everyone. I'll talk to you during the morning conference call tomorrow." He heard a chorus of goodbyes and walked out to his truck. Then he pulled out of the plaza and crossed Beachmont to the Kroger a block away and parked near the back of the lot. He made sure he had his wallet and walked to the entrance and grabbed a cart and pushed it along, getting some basic stuff like bread and cheese and lunch meat and peanut butter. No intention of making this a big trip, like when you plan for the whole week. Just trying to get some food the kids would eat over the next couple of days. He also picked up a huge tumbler of creatine and nestled it in the cart next to the food. A few years ago, he'd been super fat, real chunky around the jowls and gut, but he'd caught himself at some point and slimmed down, went to the gym every day to run. He didn't understand the runner's high, never experienced it himself, but it kept his mood a little more even and his weight down. The creatine was for lifting, since he did that often too. He'd do a 30-minute set of different resistance exercises and then drink a creatine shake, get nice and bulky in the shoulders and biceps. He liked that. Two years shy of 50, he was looking and feeling better than he did 10 years ago. He didn't like his face all that much, kind of long, with a loose flap of skin under his jaw that you got when you aged. But other than that, you might have called him fit. Maybe that's why Kylie fucked him. John, her husband, was big and fat. And maybe Kylie didn't want to have to push up someone's belly to suck dick every time. Really, he thought maybe he was actually a cut above Kylie. If she was a 6.5, he thought he was probably a 7 or a 7.5. Kylie had a nice face, but she was too tall for a girl, and her thighs, which served her well when she was playing soccer in college, didn't look too great without plants. Just too muscled and thick. Her tits could have been bigger, too. It was all right, though. She was good to fuck. That's all he really wanted, someone nice to fuck other than his wife. He knew Kylie did it mainly for the job security, the pay raise. She had told him numerous times that she did not want to divorce John. Fine with him. He wouldn't have exchanged the mother of his children for her under any circumstance that he could think of. After he picked up the items he needed, he edited the U-scan line. All 6 scanners were in use, and 2 people even stood in front of him in line. Another 6 scanners adjacent to these were offline for whatever reason, which pissed him off. A year ago, these 6 scanners had been 2 cashier lanes, and he just loved how they decreased convenience in the name of increasing it, since these new extra scanners were always fucking closed. This is what people in his industry called bad customer experience. You couldn't expect a customer to be loyal if they had a shitty time at the point of sale. Point of sale should be seamless and easy. Not bullshit like this. He tapped his feet and gritted his teeth as he waited. When he finally got to a scanner, having stood for maybe 6 or 7 minutes, he rang up his items and bagged them. The scanner must have been fucked up because a couple of times the screen told him he had to scan items before bagging them, as if he was trying to steal shit. He waited for the scanner to realize that he had scanned before bagging, then continued ringing himself out. After putting the last item in a bag, he pressed the button to check out, but the screen alerted him again that he needed to scan all items before bagging them. He growled and waited for the screen to go away. After 15 seconds, when it hadn't gone away, he pushed the call attendant button to get the problem sorted out. He looked up and saw the attendant chatting up another customer, her huge body grotesque in the blue Kroger uniform, her dark hair hanging over her lumpy shoulders to rest above the love handles over her hips. "Hurry the fuck up," he said to himself, not a whisper, but not loud enough for the attendant to hear. The attendant continued chatting with the other customer for a while, and Mick grew angrier and angrier at the sight of her backside, her giant, dumpy ass filling out her black jeans and her bare, thick elbows rounded like Popeye's. His eyes started to twitch a little, and his shoulders jerked around. He kept staring at her. He punched the call button a bunch of times, but nothing seemed to faze her. She talked and talked and talked. Fed up, Mick walked over to her. "Hey, I need some help over here." She turned around and smiled at him. Oh, sorry about that. Let me help. She followed him over to a scanner and pressed a bunch of buttons on the screen. The image changed several times, but nothing she did seemed to have any effect. Nonetheless, she continued her business slowly and patiently, humming a little bit under her breath. Mick couldn't fucking take it. Her hand moved on the screen at quarter speed, like everyone else was in a time trap, and he had to watch time play out nearly frozen like this for the rest of his life. Hurry! Speed up! Speed up! Speed up! Jesus! He hated her pale, chubby hand on the screen, her pale arm running back from it, her hair over her shoulders, her body, the sound of her voice. He wanted to bash her face into the screen, slam it over and over. Move, you slow, stupid, fat, ugly steer. Move. In the next instant, he both knew and did not know what happened. He knew that he had caused it, but he did not know how it was possible that he had caused it. Things such as this did not happen in the real world. In the real world, nothing changed. Nothing or extraordinary or good really happened. The events of life tended to be neutral or bad, and you had happiness when you relaxed or when you came, and you had unhappiness when shit you thought would be fine turned out not fine. That's it. So Mick was dumbstruck when the attendant backed up a little bit from the screen and dropped her arm, her flesh grazing his for a bare flash of a second. When that happened, Mick felt all of his hate surge into her, a current like electricity flowing from his body into hers, and she transformed. Her skin and clothes exploded away, shredding themselves into bloody rags onto the surrounding scanners and wire shelves, onto Mick and the other customers. What stood upright in her place when her body resolved tearing apart was somewhat akin to a giant nightcrawler, except instead of pinkish-red flesh, it was covered in tan-ribbed skin. Nor were its endpoints tapered like a nightcrawler's. Rather, these endpoints were open, giving the creature a tubular or cylindrical shape. The lower endpoint was folded up a little bit so that the creature seemed to shamble about on what Mick might have termed its knees, a greenish-yellow ooze seeping up from this bottom part of its tube. Its upper endpoint sloshed the same liquid as it moved around very slowly, a slime covering the floor in its wake. Everyone watched it wriggle around for 2 or 3 seconds, a human-sized worm where the U-scan attendant had been, before screaming erupted and a chaos of movement ensued. So that's it. That is the last portion of the first chapter, kind of the inciting incident of the novel.
Thank you very much, Patrick. And you said that this will be out and available by the time this episode airs.
Right.
And so I'm curious because I know that you are very driven in your writing and in the readings the books that you're primarily attracted to stories that are really trying to convey like clear messages about things.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious, one, I guess like this is like a two-parter. Have you ever done anything like magical realist like this before or like surreal? I'm not sure what you would call it. And two, did the idea of a person psychically able to transform other people into worms come before the what led you to that? Is that something that came early in the idea for the novel, or did that come like later?
Well, to answer the second part of the question, the novel germinated in the convergence of two ideas. I knew that I wanted to write a novel using a character very similar to an old boss I had. And I wanted to explore a character like this to kind of look at an antisocial psyche in the context of capitalism and work culture and corporate culture. But I also wanted to draw attention to like how horrible and disgusting this kind of psyche is and this kind of culture is by exploring body horror. Like I'm a big David Cronenberg fan. Like I really love his movies. You know, even the ones that aren't body horror, but the you know, some of his earlier stuff. I remember Hans, you showed me Videodrome, which is a crazy whacked out movie that's awesome. He's just got a lot of good stuff. So, and like John Carpenter's The Thing, I think that's John Carpenter, which isn't quite body horror, but it's, you know, it's very body horror-esque. So that's kind of how I came up with this idea. Like, you know, how am I going to explore this disgusting antisocial personality? What better way than to kind of come up with a body horror style idea? So that's where the like worm thing came out. So that's where it came from. To answer the first part, I have never written magical realism, and I don't think I consider this magical realism.
You mentioned that you know, part of your goal was to convey how disgusting this kind of mindset and culture is. How do you handle writing the viewpoint of a character who's kind of like designed to be awful as part of the, you know, the thematic agenda of the work? How do you handle writing a character who's designed to be awful and yet at the same time has to, at least I assume you wanted him to, like has to also, to some extent, exist as a full-fledged person, right? As a
right.
Well-rounded human, if not even a likable
right.
or sympathetic one.
Yeah, that. So one idea that I also had for this novel, because, you know, I wanna write a novel, not like just an allegory, right? You know, I want
right.
I at least I hope that I've written a novel, not just an allegory for, you know, disgusting corporate culture. But so what I tried to do is. What I try to do in the novel is front end a lot of the disgusting stuff. And I don't mean like the disgusting horror stuff. I mean the disgusting antisocial corporate stuff. Like I try to front end a lot of that in the novel to really like lay it on thick that this guy's a piece of shit, a disgusting human being. But then as the novel goes along, I try to add deeper and deeper bits of humanity to this character. Now, it's up to the reader to say whether I've been successful or not. But so, you know, for example, later on in the novel, I try to show that he has a deep attachment to his children. And mm-hmm. then later on after that, I try to show that there are things that he is trying to work on in his life. He is somewhat amenable to change, and he is somewhat attuned to certain problems in the world, like climate change is, now it's all filtered through his, you know, kind of right-leaning wacko ideology, but it's still an attempt, as futile as it is, to try to empathize with the outside world. And that kind of comes later in the novel. So hopefully I'm successful in that. But again, you know, you'd have to be the judge.
That's a very interesting strategy, actually, because, and I don't know if I have any good examples of this off the top of my head. First one I can think of, well, I guess I should convey the idea and then give the example. But like, I was thinking about, you know, the way that you've described it, you're like front loading all the awfulness of the character and then over time kind of giving us a better sense of the ways in which he is, if not redeemable, then at least not fully awful, right?
Right.
You front load us with the most disgusting aspects and then allow the humanity to kind of creep out over time. And that's fascinating to me because I think it's the opposite of how a lot of people would handle that, where you front load someone who seems reasonably either appealing or at least in some ways a mixed bag, and then over time you discover actually the kind of core of awfulness in them. Off the top of my head, none of these are book examples, but I recently rewatched the Robert Altman film The Player, where Tim Robbins' character initially like kind of a sympathetic dope, and then by the end of the movie you realize that he's a completely unredeemable sociopath.
Yeah. That's a good movie.
Breaking Bad kind of is a bit of that model over a very long period of time. The TV series The Curse, you know, the character that Emma Stone plays in The Curse. I don't know if either of you guys have seen that, but she initially seems like, again, somebody who, you know, is self-centered and kind of has that capitalist gross mindset, but cares about climate change and is in some way trying to do good. And as the series goes on, is revealed more and more to be completely one-dimensional in it, like this one-dimensionally selfish, very, you know, essentially evil person. And spoiler alert for The Curse, I guess. And so it's interesting to me that I think usually people would go through the, you know, you make the character initially sympathetic to bring people into the novel or the movie or the series. And then over time you reveal the awfulness after people have some attachment and identification with that character. And so there's something very daring about hitting people with a giant kind of wet rag of horrible. And then over time kind of pulling them into some greater amount of sympathy and identification. And I wonder, how do you make the novel readable when you're leading off with the worst aspects of your protagonist?
Well, I that's where, like, I hoped that the comedy aspect would come in. Again, you know, I've got a pretty dark, pessimistic sense of humor, but you know, I really wanted to really highlight the satire at the beginning and really kind of make it, you know, so that you can't miss the point. Like, this guy, you know, the SAP executive asks him, you know, can we have a more diverse set of panelists? So he cracks a pretty horrible transphobic, racist, homophobic joke, right? And so I was trying to create a sort of cringe comedy aspect as a way to draw people in. You know, plenty of people like cringe comedy. It's a mainstay in TV and pretty much everywhere, really. So it seemed like an all right strategy.
I remember you talking about when you were trying to find a publisher, the challenge of encountering publishers who wanted to tone down the unpleasantness of the protagonist, right? So, you know, but you did find someone who would run with that.
Right.
So, you know, it does seem like that strategy, I mean, I think it kind of probably produces an effect where I haven't read the whole book yet. I guess I shouldn't admit that because I gave you a blurb for it. But I read enough of it to blurb it and then thought, you know, I don't want to read the whole thing. I don't want to read this whole thing as a Word document, right? Like, I actually want to sit down with a physical copy of this and, like, take it in as I would a book that I was excited about. You know, I didn't want to just kind of, I don't know, I just hate reading. I hate reading literature in that format, you know. But it sounds like you've written something that, I mean, one strategy, one effect of the artistic strategy we've been talking about, where you kind of front load the least savory parts, is that, you know, it creates something that hopefully is going to have a narrow band of readers, but people in that narrow band will be very interested in it and devoted to it, right?
Like, you've
you're self-selecting for a very attentive audience.
Yeah, probably. I mean, I self-selecting unconsciously. Like, I didn't necessarily, like, I wasn't necessarily thinking of this as a marketing strategy, more as a like an aesthetic strategy. But, you know, sure. Yeah. I mean, hopefully, I can get some devoted readers. That would be even just a handful would be great. You know,
I'll say that like there is, I think. In comedy, I think there's a pretty established lane for despicable main characters,
right,
that really like are irredeemable and continuously over many seasons prove themselves to be, you know, maybe even worse than you originally thought.
Right.
And, you know, going back to Seinfeld, but, you know, more recently, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Right.
Purchase Gusineau at Anxiety Press. I'm going to order a copy.
I'll try to get you a free one.
Don't get us free copies.
Let us purchase it.
All right. Fair enough.
I mean, I appreciate it, but you know, I would like to do with the honor of paying for it.
All right. Well, I appreciate it.
Yeah, when we're not recording, I'm gonna ask you to send me a free copy.
All right. Well, just make sure you cut this part out.
No, I'm joking. Yeah. Anything else about Gusineau, Patrick?
No. Hopefully that little excerpt whetted your appetite for more crazy worm horror. If not, you know, there's nothing else I can do. But thank you for listening.
I only hope that at some point the tubular worms are compared to masturbators. That's my one hope. I'm gonna read it.
Well, I don't know if I make that exact joke, but there's
a cock sleeve. Yeah,
there's definitely.
It seems like it's right there.
There's definitely some good, disturbing stuff ahead. In a dirty vein, definitely.
Awesome. All right. Well, we're gonna move on to talking about the middle part of Underworld, or the panis. Of Underworld.
Panis?
Is
that a word?
The panis, you know. Yeah, it's the fold of an obese person over their, like a morbidly obese person over their pants that kind of like, you know, that like sags forward
their tummy
and down. Yeah, but it's a panis when it sort of droops like melting wax.
Sure, okay.
And often people lose things in there or the skin fuses together.
Crazy.
But
I've never heard that word.
Yeah. Well, this is the perfect example of a panis in literature, because I think that you and I have similar feelings about the middle of it. Of Underworld. I deeply, deeply enjoy pieces of it, but
right.
It's very... I think it's actually kind of hard to think about this book in pieces because of how it follows different threads and different directions. And I assume that they come back together in some way at the end, that is maybe a little bit easier to hold on to them, but stopping in the middle like this, like there's just a bunch of like we're following side characters, you know, at different points of their lives, and it's just kind of hard to circumscribe all of this. So Hans, forgive me at the very least. I'm going to rely on you a little bit, to kind of make sense of this.
Yeah. Well, and I don't know that I can totally make full sense of it for you, right? Because I don't think that it is. So, I mean, in the first couple of sections, as we've divided it, you know, when we were talking about the triumph of death, the opening section, when we were talking about the first roughly third of the main book. I think like the frame that I seized on, and I've read this book a few times, and I don't know if I'd ever really consciously thought about this frame before, but like the frame that I seized on to help make sense of it then was the collision between, or the interaction between, the kind of myth of history, or the mythical version of history, and the kind of quotidian day-to-day of history, right? And I think that's still a helpful frame to think about those things. But I think that at the, you know, in the beginning of the novel, those worlds are pretty, those worlds are kind of kept somewhat remote from each other. The boundaries are easily understandable. The line between the two is defined in a pretty helpful way. And I think that you can, in roughly like the first half of the novel, you know, you can pull out pretty clear kind of thematic statements about how those things relate, right? Like we had talked about, you know, the ways in which the real history of the baseball is unknowable to any of the characters. The real history of the Texas Highway Killer is unknowable to any of the characters. The ways in which the mythical version of something is ultimately... the mythical version of something is kind of, you can't really understand that without understanding these day-to-day realities that are unrecorded in history, right? You can invent an understanding, but you can't have true understanding without knowing these day-to-day realities that are ultimately lost to, just lost, right? And there's a bit at the end that I think complicates that in interesting ways that we aren't to yet. I will say, like, the very end of the novel, I think, starts to approach how technology affects that in ways that sometimes seem sublime to me and sometimes seem, like, so ridiculous that they undercut a great deal of what came before. But we'll talk about that when it happens. But, I mean, I do think that as the novel moves roughly backward in time, a lot of those reasonably clear themes and divisions in the first half become more and more scrambled. And I think that's to some extent deliberate, right? There's a kind of, you know, when I think about what this novel is doing structurally, and this is one of the questions that I didn't send you ahead of time, and it may just be me discoursing for a while and you can, you know, respond as you see fit. But when I think about what the novel is doing structurally, I'm struck by the fact that most of the section titles are songs, right? Cocksucker Blues is a Rolling Stones song. Elegy for Left Hand Alone is a piano piece written for people who've had their right hand amputated. Long Tall Sally is a soul song that is discussed pretty explicitly. I think there's another one. There might be another section title that's a song. I can't remember. The odd one out there is Cloud of Unknowing, which is has become the title of a number of songs, but I believe that at the time DeLillo picked it, I think was not known as a song title so much as the title of a work of Christian mysticism from the 14th century. But the point I'm trying to make is that, to me, thinking about how the structure and the arrangement of the sections works, it feels almost like there's more of a musical quality to how they interact, right? You know, the section, the first big section that we talked about, I can't remember what it's called. The first big section that we talked about, there's this effect where you have fairly long chapters, and each of those chapters, when you transition to a new chapter, there's kind of a passing side character from one chapter who becomes your protagonist for another, right? So it's like this kind of, almost like a series of songs where like a minor theme from one song is turned into the main theme of the next song, right?
That's interesting.
And the section... I believe it's the Cocksucker Blues section. Instead of having a series of viewpoint characters, you have chapters that are about the same length, but you know, you just go back and forth between Clara Sachs's viewpoint and Matt Shea's viewpoint, right? So it becomes a bit more like extended counterpoint between two themes, or extended interplay between two themes, right? And the final section that we read, Better Things for Better Living Through Chemistry, is this much more kind of fragmented collage. So I've come to think of it less as, I've come to think of what it's doing structurally is almost something that's trying to, it's less kind of an essayistic structure or a novelistic structure, and more something that exchanges themes, exchanges ideas, plays with ideas at varying lengths in a way that feels more like a series of different musical structures. And that, you know, that's a little bit of a cop-out, I suppose, in some ways, because it makes it maybe harder to talk about the relationship between structure and theme, or it makes it easy to write off the relationship between structure and theme. But I think until reading the novel this time, I don't think I had really thought as consciously about how each of those long sections has a different structural motif that's like actually very deliberate and very, you know, if you just read the whole thing if you read the whole thing without thinking about it section by section, I think that it feels chaotic in how the different characters are connected and how the different threads advance. And it is somewhat chaotic, but that the varying structures between each section do give it a sense of order that, you know, it makes a kind of intuitive sense, even though I'm not sure that I could necessarily say exactly how those structural features relate to the main theme, right? I don't know if any of that makes any sense to you guys at any level or if it resonates at all. It is, I don't think that it's necessarily, I think that the novel is kind of interested more in, it's interested less in making distinct concrete points and more in the kind of, there's a quickening effect as you, especially when you go into that last section we read, the Better Things for Better Living Through Chemistry, where mm-hmm. you have such small bits from so many different times and they're all swirled together. And it's this, there's this effect that happens where the beginning of the novel is set essentially in the present, or the present of the novel. It's set it's kind of set in its own present. It has this kind of peaceful quality, and it's both the events in the novel, the worlds of the characters, and the kind of tone are kind of calm and quiet and staid. And, you know, as you go further and further back toward this kind of, as you go further and further back toward both the kind of mythical moment of the baseball game and the personal moment for Nick Shea of committing manslaughter, there's a sort of descent into fragmentation and chaos and noise, right? And I think that I've always thought of that as kind of, you know, you experience the present in a very linear way, right? You experience and the present, like much of anyone's present, is a kind of like quiet and calm, or maybe not calm, but much of anybody's present is essentially like unremarkable quotidian things. And the further that you go back into memory, the further that you go back in time, the more kind of chopped up and garbled things become, the more fragmentary memory becomes, the more our sense of the world, you know, our personal recollection of something kind of gets overtaken with history and culture and media, you know. And I've always thought of like the way that the structure changes as it moves backward as imitating that effect. But it is, to be fair, like a lot of time and space to spend with something that's more interested in, at least that I've ever been able to pull out of it, something that's more interested in using pace and tone and chapter length to kind of create a subjective effect. It's much more interested in that than it is any kind of, you know, conventional plot suspense or, you know, very clear articulation of themes. and even kind of the theme that, you know, we drew out of the first half becomes a bit lost relative to that fragmentizing effect and how it mimics the nature of history and memory. And I mean, I do think that to some extent, you really just have to enjoy the fragments, right? And if there's anything wrong aesthetically with the novel, even to, you know, kind of a fanboy who sucks its dick like me, if there's anything wrong... if there's anything wrong with the aesthetics of the novel, it's that particularly, you know, when you get into the Better Things for Better Living section, some of those fragments are more entertaining than others, notably, right? Some of those fragments are funnier or cleverer or more original. Some of them almost feel less like, some of them feel a bit obligatory. And I think like the variation in quality, you know, when you go into that kind of chopped up, blended portion, the variation in quality between different sections, which has always been an aspect of the book, it becomes much more apparent because you're moving so quickly between tones and sections and characters.
Hans, you said the titles of the sections are mostly songs, and that gives us a hint that, you know, the structure of the novel is kind of trying to mimic, or maybe not mimic, but investigate song structure, which would tie in with the fact that DeLillo uses a ton of music vocabulary just in his descriptions. Like, he talks about diminished chords and other various terminology. And I was wondering, are the songs that are referenced, are those from different genres, or are they some, or are they similar genres? Like, is there, like, for example, I know you love prog rock. If all the songs were from prog rock, the prog rock genre, then maybe there would be something like else to think about in the structure of the novel. Like, this is trying to mimic a song from some prog band.
Yeah, that would make sense. And I don't know that. Unfortunately, I don't really think that you can get there in ways that I'm not able to get there, right? Like, Long Tall Sally. Long Tall Sally is a Little Richard song from the 50s.
Oh, okay.
It's kind of, I mean, it's Little Richard, right? It's short, it's chaotic, it's loud, it's libidinous. Really nothing like the actual Long Tall Sally section, which is really kind of like the, almost like the aftermath of history in a way.
Right.
The Long Tall Sally, of course, is the character who's painted on the fuselage of the bomber that Nick sees. So Clara has the art installation where she's painting the bombers, the kind of discarded bombers. And Long Tall Sally is on the nose of one of the bombers that Nick sees when he visits that project. And then toward the very end of the last section that we read, there's a bombing run that's conducted in Long Tall Sally. So, you know, there's a connection there in terms of that image popping up. And I believe that is kind of part of why, like, the bomber Long Tall Sally is kind of also living in the aftermath of history in the way that Nick is, right? It's kind of like it's being turned into an art piece after being decommissioned at the end of the Cold War. And that's kind of a version of the quietude that Nick is living in at the end of the novel. I think in that sense, it's the calling attention to that plane is significant. But the song Long Tall Sally, I'm not really able to come up with any way to map that onto the theme or the structure or the style of that section. Probably the closest you could come is Cocksucker Blues, which is a kind of exhausted, dissolute 70s decadence kind of, lo-fi Rolling Stones song. That probably does to some extent match some of the vibe of that section and comes from the same era. But Unfortunately, the songs that he's chosen are not necessarily keys to kind of thinking about how the structures work in the kind of musical way that I was talking about, which, you know, I mean, there's probably a missed opportunity there, right? Like, I mean, I think that DeLillo is someone who, you know, if you aren't completely on the wavelength of what he's doing, it's very easy to get hints of how he could do something that was more conventionally likable or, you know, good by, like, the standards of fiction that most people adhere to, right? Like, he does get away with ignoring a lot of opportunities to write something that is just kind of, from a certain standpoint, better, right? And I mean, I think, like, that's, you know, to some extent, a missed opportunity, right? And he's not really... He does seem like he's interested in doing other things, but at the same time, like, it is something that could have made all this somewhat more logical. And maybe there is a way that all this can be kind of, you know, maybe actually there's a version of doing that I'm missing. But
Is that why every now and then there's a conversation that seems like it's going to lead somewhere and then doesn't? Like, you know, you're talking about missed opportunities, and maybe to kind of bring this up in a way that is not adversarial. Like, I mentioned in chat beforehand that, you know, there was...
Wait, hold on. Let's read your question word for word. I want to read it. Oh, hold on. This is, okay. One of my questions would be, why does DeLillo refuse to pursue interesting conversations in favor of inconclusive rambling?
Well, that was just for Chad. I wasn't, you know, for...
No.
For DeLilloans.
You don't have to...
I'm not trying to alienate DeLilloans.
They're going to be fine. I think that you don't need to censor yourself.
Right.
I don't, you know, if you still feel that way, maybe, or unless Hans has convinced you otherwise.
The example I gave was that there's a conversation where somebody says one thing, another person says, well, so you're not a Buddhist. And it seems like we're going to have this cool riff on how Buddhism relates to the current conversation, but then the character...
I think it's Marion and her parents, right? Isn't it Marion and her parents?
And Marion lets the thought drift away into smoke or whatever the description is. And I'm just like, oh, DeLillo, you did it again. DeLillo, you did it again. Why can't we have like just a cool philosophical conversation? That's what I want to know. And I was wondering if that's something that, you know, the non-DeLilloan might take as a missed opportunity.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Hans. Like, there's something about the way in which DeLillo navigates around very fixed, objectively... fixed, objectively measurable reference points that reminds me a little bit of, like, what, you know, how Raymond Carver resisted knowing, like, the ends of his stories before, you know, he started writing them. Like, there's something that feels like a through line there, where some writers like to outline everything and know, like, what they're writing to and what they're trying to say. And then some writers like to discover, and some writers are compelled to kind of resist knowing. And that it's kind of a different take on that. But it feels like DeLillo would prefer to kind of... we always go back, or I always go back to the quantum. DeLillo prefers a kind of a quantum sort of, like, relationship to like potentiality. Like, there's always like a potential. There's so much potential that DeLillo puts in front of you that he doesn't tend to explicitly realize, if that makes sense. Maybe that's something that has to do with like what sort of attracts him to writing in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, I think that to some extent, well, I don't know for sure what you mean by unrealized potential. There's a version of that that I was thinking about the first couple times that I read this novel. You know, we've talked a little bit about the Manx Martin chapters. And, or, well, we haven't really in this podcast. One of the questions was about the Manx Martin chapters. And to clarify, the Manx Martin being at the very beginning of this book, the character Cotter Martin gets the baseball from a very key moment in a very well-known game, takes it home to his father. His father steals it and sells it to somebody in line at a baseball game. And
For $32. Yeah.
And the first couple times that I read this, I kept waiting for something to happen in the final Manx Martin section that would completely kind of recontextualize or undercut all the stuff with the baseball before that, right? I kept waiting for wouldn't it be ironic if at the very end of the section, Manx Martin can't sell the baseball and he says, ah, fuck it, and throws it in the river and that's that, right? And then it turns out that the actual baseball is lost history, and the kind of baseball that Nick has that we follow through the novel is just a fake, right? Wouldn't that be a clever reversal? But, like, I mean, I suppose just the fact that I saw that possibility coming kind of invalidates it as a novelistic strategy, right? The fact that as a reader, as a first or second time reader, I can wonder if he'll make that move, in a metafictional way, kind of obviates the point of making that move, right? As a reader, as a reader with some familiarity for what things do, you are playing that possibility out, and that kind of, you know, you can imagine that possibility, and in a way that kind of makes it something that is explored. Which is, I don't know, like maybe that's a little bit of a silly, I don't even know if that's a defense exactly, maybe that's a silly way to think of it, but I do think that DeLillo he's smart enough to see the possibility of doing something like that and then recognize that a lot of readers are going to anticipate that and that is kind of renders it pointless, right? I mean, Patrick, in the context of the Buddhist thing, if I remember right, it's Marion and her parents are listening to an account of they're listening to the radio as there's a semi-violent student protest during the 60s kind of era of campus radicalism. And I believe that Marion's father, there's some reference to violence toward the protesters and somebody says, oh, well, not a Buddhist. And like, I mean, I think you know the idea of Buddhism well enough that you can kind of make the connection that's being drawn there, right? Like, you can imagine what that conversation would be. Can
sure.
you not?
Yeah, I mean, I can.
So, I mean, I think, again, that kind of, like, I think that he is, DeLillo, I think, is somebody who, I think that what you said, Chris, about the quantum, about the unrealized thing, that's actually an interesting way to think of it. Like, I think that he is a writer who, he's a writer who, what am I trying to say? I think he understands the ways that readers are going to fill in those kind of unrealized possibilities, and doesn't really, I mean, in a way you kind of do that work for yourself and he doesn't bother, right? Because he has other agendas. And I mean, the agendas that he does have may be, the agenda that he does have might be something that you don't like or enjoy or find value in. But I mean, I do think that he's interested enough in doing the particular thing that he wants to do that, yeah, he is someone who will ignore certain possibilities, sometimes frustratingly so. I mean, to the question of why does he let those conversations trail? Why does he not kind of why is there not like a couple pages about, you know, the difference between how a Buddhist and a non-Buddhist would relate to campus radicalism? Because he wanted to do what he did instead, ultimately. And I mean, that's kind of an unsatisfying way to frame it, but it's the best thing that I have. And I think that it's to some extent, you know, I mean, he's a, this is maybe a kind of a cliche or a cop-out way to phrase it, but like, I think DeLillo as a writer, he is much more interested in questions than in resolutions, right? He's interested in kind of, I think most of the conversations that the characters do have are more about possibilities and questions and uncertainties than they are about laying out fixed meanings. And you know, that's, I can see why that would be annoying, right? And in some places it's more entertaining than others, but it's, I think that's roughly why he does what he does, because he's interested in the things that we do get, right? The textures of moments, the intersections of kind of mythical and quotidian, the interesting questions that are raised without necessarily having answers given, the kind of structural effect that I was talking about. That's what he's interested in. That's what he wants to do. And plot-based surprise, lengthy philosophical, more defined lengthy philosophical digressions. Those are...
Yeah, give me that.
Not,
that's what I
not
want.
Things that he's incapable of, but things that he's not interested in doing in this setting. He's not someone who... You know, you were when we were talking about your novel fragment, Chris, you, or not your fragment, but the section of your novel that you read, like you were very thoughtful about how you draw a reader through what you have, right? How you draw a reader through what you want to do by including kind of more conventionally appealing things, such as dark humor. And I think DeLillo is someone who is able to get away, to varying degrees, I guess, depending on how much you like him, but from a career standpoint, he's been able to get away with completely ignoring the things that many people would find attractive in a novel.
Maybe. It just occurred to me that I hadn't made this connection before you started talking about this, Hans, but Lenny Bruce goes through basically this exact thing in the sections that we just read. He's
I like
in the middle of a set, and he is basically, this is directly following the Cuban Missile Crisis. Lenny Bruce had been kind of invigorated in a kind of anxious, terrible way by the Cuban Missile Crisis. He is yeah, he's scared like everybody else, but there's something about it that's like energizing him. And then the Cuban Missile Crisis resolves, and he's giving a set afterward. And basically, you know, everyone in the audience wants to laugh because, like, everyone's so relieved. And it's like, you know, his jokes are landing and... You know, everything is working out, but the his old jokes, his old style is not really fulfilling him, and so he decides to kind of workshop a joke in front of them, and he constantly undermines the trajectory of the joke by predicting where the audience would expect it to go, and ultimately is very it's not working out, and he goes back to, you know, his kind of dirty insightful humor, easier to follow jokes. But there it's remarkable that, you know, you described DeLillo that way and weren't thinking about that scene with Lenny Bruce, because it's exactly that. Like he is doing it really for himself, and then ultimately retreats from that position because he's making people he's not performing well as a comic. He's disappointing people. So like you asked Patrick, you know, like how he gets away with it. I don't know. Other than
Lenny Bruce doesn't.
Lenny Bruce doesn't, but like there's this magic to like Lenny Bruce. I don't know Lenny Bruce's humor very much other than like what I've sort of read and heard about like how people, especially in comedy, just revere him. You know, they basically just, and when you revere someone to that extent, you give them a lot of leeway. And I'm glad that like DeLillo gets the leeway that he gets, because there's so much that is beautiful and interesting in this book, which I called this middle section the Panis, and I really did struggle with this middle section a lot, but I loved parts of it. And I don't know that those parts would exist without the rest of it. Like there's no space, there's no topia in which those insights, those moments, J. Edgar Hoover's at a masquerade party, and it's interrupted by people doing a kind of obscure protest. I don't know that these types of moments are happened upon in a more traditional novel. And so even as I'm very frustrated with it, and I don't know that he gets away with all of it, I was, a pretty bored with parts of it and just elated with others. And ultimately I'm glad that the parts that elated me exist. Glad enough that I think that I'm happy that he gets away with it, which I guess means that he gets away with it. It's tautological. if you like it, he gets away with it. So like, does that answer your question a little bit?
It does, actually. It puts it in perspective. He gets away with it with the people that he gets away with it with, right?
Exactly.
I'm not one of those people. You know, there were, like, you're saying, Chris, that you were elated with some parts and bored with others. And I was bored with some parts and, you know, found other parts enjoyable. So, like, not certainly not the heights that you did. Like, as I said in chat, you know, the Manx Martin chapters, the J. Edgar Hoover sections, I thought were pretty interesting, pretty enjoyable, but not enough to kind of offset the, you know, the panis that is smothering me.
I think that's totally reasonable. I mean, I think, again, to the question of how he gets away with it, you know, we've said a version of this, a variation of this over and over at this point, but like, he has a particular kind of charisma as a sentence level writer.
Yes, he does.
He has a particular kind of, and there are people who are pleased enough with that effect that they're willing to follow it wherever it may go. And I'm one of those people. And then there are people who might appreciate some of that, but kind of don't just at whatever subjective level like it enough to forgive the, to forgive the ways in which the novels are generally uninterested in doing novelistic things.
Right.
I think he gets away with it just through a particular kind of charisma that appeals to a particular kind of person. And it, I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, Chris, you kind of raised I think maybe not deliberately, but you've raised the question of, if he had done this project with somewhat less fame, credit, and clout, and an editor had come along who trimmed about 30% of it and said, no, you do have to have something happen at the end that is interesting plot-wise, right? Like, you have to have something happen at the end that actually really changes in a seismic way the meaning of the beginning. You know, I suppose, it probably would have been a better novel then, but also, I don't know that he would have undertaken this project if he hadn't been someone who was in the position that he was, where White Noise had been so successful and Libra was so acclaimed, and he kind of had the clout to do it, right? Like, I don't know that, I mean, ultimately, you just kind of, you can, with any work of art, really, because there are so few perfect works of art, it's a challenge to kind of critically think about the ways in which you might have handled something differently without allowing that to cloud the extent to which you enjoy what works well, right? Like, that's always a challenge, I think, for me, right, with any work. And, I think we all have, in some ways, a version of that experience with this book, but I think the ways that we balance those two competing impulses are different, mostly just because of kind of irreducible taste things.
Well, speaking of irreducible taste, one thing that I find extremely interesting in my reaction and in your reaction, Hans, is that every time I read DeLillo now, on a sentence level, I'm always struck by how similar he is to Cormac McCarthy, whom I really enjoy and you don't. I'm not sure where you stand, Chris, like whether you really enjoy him or whatnot. But I find that they use similes and metaphors in extremely similar ways, in that they will often take a concrete image or relationship and then build a simile from it or a metaphor from it that is abstract. DeLillo says something about brothers. He how brothers have like some kind of confrontational relationship. It's from the first part. That really struck me as similar to McCarthy, but yet we have such different reactions to it. I find it interesting. There's nothing more to say other than I find it interesting how they're similar in this way, and yet we have very different reactions to the authors.
To both DeLillo and McCarthy. I mean, for what it's worth, I don't know how clear I was about it when we did it on the podcast, but I really, really, really enjoyed The Passenger.
Right.
It took me a while to get on its wavelength, as it would, I think, anybody. But, like, I thought I actually loved The Passenger.
Oh, and, okay.
Thought Stella Maris was pretty good, too. I think part of the reason I haven't gone on to other McCarthy after The Passenger was just I sort of assumed it was not that much like his other work.
Yeah.
I'm almost scared of being disappointed in a way, right? Like, I liked The Passenger so much, and I think of it as so unlike kind of, I mean, I think of him as usually doing, this is kind of a gross term, but elevated Westerns, right? And I didn't want to go pick up another McCarthy and then I get like, you know, troubled stoic men considering how to shoot each other.
Right. He kind of does do elevated Westerns. The Crossing, which is way more philosophical and way more philosophical than probably All the Pretty Horses, which is like kind of his, maybe not the novel that he's known for, Blood Meridian, is more philosophical too, but like All the Pretty Horses is probably like the commercially like elevated Western that everybody thinks of. The Passenger is great. Sutri is the most like it of his other novels. It's like a funny, ironic novel that takes place in Tennessee about a bunch of, like, it's one central character who meets a bunch of ragamuffins, and it's episodic and vignette like. So it's you would probably like Sutri if you like The Passenger too, though to a lesser extent.
Which of his novels is most like Underworld by Don DeLillo?
I don't know, because, yeah, maybe. I mean, but The Passenger is so much better than Underworld. I mean, no offense. I think it's better.
It's fine. Yeah, I really like them both. I don't see any need to pit them against each other.
Right.
I am very fond of both novels.
Isn't the distinction between, and I'm going to try to veer us back toward DeLillo now.
My bad.
As much as you are one, would rather talk about McCarthy.
Well, and I think, I mean, in the defense of that section, like, I think, Patrick, you did make some really interesting points about sentence level style.
Yeah, I think they just have a very sentence level similarity is the main thing I wanted to say.
Yeah.
Well, I think the back side of that question, which I think is also valuable, is like what makes them distinct, and it's sort of what makes DeLillo distinct from most writers, is how, going back again to, and when I said like DeLillo's aversion to realizing the potential. What I meant was more in line with what Lenny Bruce was thinking when he was sort of recasting the trajectory of the joke as he was telling it, which is that, like, oh God, the audience is waiting for me to return to this, you know, to return to this thing that I had introduced in the beginning in this particular way. Because that's how jokes are told. And he resists that in a way that is inherently interesting and compelling. And I think that that is kind of resisting the potential of audience expectations based on the medium in which the author or comedian is engaging with that audience. And any great artist is doing that, but I think for the most part, any great artist is doing that. But for the most part, I think the artist is still usually trying to construct something that within the context of the creation, you're given the tools by which to understand it. In DeLillo, I think McCarthy usually does that. I think that The Passenger and Stella Maris are like a little different. They're a little more open-ended. They're a little bit more like the ending is a little bit more up for interpretation in a more like complicated way than maybe Blood Meridian is very symbolic. I don't know all of his books though, so I do wonder if Sutri, I have never read it, so I'll have to read that one.
Oh, it's great.
But DeLillo, it seems, is actually even resistant to giving you the tools to understand his books within the books themselves, while also resisting the temptation to kind of cleave to, you know, tropes under, you know, like sort of like well-traded tropes or well-traded sort of like story beats, character arcs, stuff like that. So like there is, instead, it feels like part of the transaction of DeLillo is him creating a space in which you participate in creating the understanding at just a higher level with like way larger sandboxes for constructing understanding kind of on your own. I am going to be looking for not necessarily like a bow, because I think Hans, you've done a lot of work preparing us, Patrick and I, for the lack of a bow, for the lack of a cigarette after sex or a mint on my pillow,
or even
or whatever
orgasm.
It is, or even that, you know, in this particular novel. But I am curious because, like, I think that. My favorite DeLillo novel is The Names, and that book has its ending in the story written by the sun, right? That's the one where like you read this short story at the end that's been written by the character of the sun, and it's, even if that doesn't quite resolve everything, what it does do is very fascinating.
And it might single-handedly elevate the names from being like a good novel to a great novel, if you believe it's either of those things, right? If you're someone who's inclined to believe it's a good novel, I think that those ending four pages of the Sun's book within a book kind of elevate it to greatness, if you believe it can get there. I'll give you guys this. There are two images in the final section that there's one way in which the two kind of main pieces of imagery of garbage and the Cold War are united. Those images are united in a particular way that is either significant and meaningless or significant and meaningful. And I think you'll know what I mean when you get to it. And the nun imagery comes back in a way that is either sublime or ridiculous. And I do think that those things, it's not just like 900 pages of what we've had and then it stops, right? Like there is an attempt to tie these things together in a way that evokes something. And so look at how garbage and the Cold War are used and look at how the nuns are used and tell me whether those are effective or absurd.
That sounds good. Thank you, Patrick. Thank you, Hans. Patrick, thank you for reading that excerpt of your new novel. Congratulations from the bottom of my heart, sir. Good friend. Check out Gusino at Anxiety Press. Buy it. And tune in next episode for the conclusion of our series on Underworld. And thank you for listening to us.